It showed a woman, face hidden, staring at an origin well. The Earth origin well, actually. Except that unlike the well Safi had grown up exploring, the illustrated version was still alive. The six beech trees around it were burgeoning, the flagstone walkway intact, and the waters swirling. As with the Paladin of Foxes, the image was nothing like any witch card Safi had seen. Ryber tapped the card back into her deck, and Safi returned her gaze to the sailors. One young man had caught her eye, his face sweaty and painfully red, and his skill with a cutlass non-existent. In the time it took Safi to crack all of her knuckles, he was disarmed twice by his opponent. The worst of it was that his opponent was not only nearing the age of retirement, but had a crippled leg, too. If Safi needed a cutlass any time soon, then this boy's was the one to nab. "Your crew," Safi said, tilting back to catch a fresh scampering of wind. "Seems divided. Some can fight, but most can't." Ryber sighed, an acknowledging sound. "We haven't had much experience. The good ones," she pointed to the old man with the limp, "fought in the war." "Isn't it your first mate's duty to make sure you improve?" Safi squinted at the tiller. Wind sent Cullen's pale hair flying, and he still muttered alongside the other witches. Merrick, however, was no longer there. "The mate isn't even watching the drills. 'Cause he's sailing us. Normally, he does push us." Something about the defensive way Ryber spoke made Safi inspect the girl more closely. Despite her boyish figure and decidedly unflattering braids, Ryber wasn't a homely girl. In fact, now that Safi was looking closely, she realized Ryber's eyes were a brilliant silver. Not gray, but true, shimmery silver. The first mate would have to be blind not to fall in love with those eyes. "So you're together?" Safi prodded.
"No,"
Ryber said quickly, much too quickly.
"He's a good first mate is all. Fair and smart."
The lie fretted down Safi's skin, and she had to bite back a smile as she slid her attention to Cullen. All she saw was an enormous man with a powerful witchery. A man who could all too easily take Safi down. Yet perhaps there was more behind his icy exterior. Ryber heaved a long sigh and plied another card from her deck. The Paladin of Hounds. She stared at the hound-like serpent, also wrapped around a sword. And there was an emptiness in her eyes that spoke of things best forgotten. But then her gaze settled on Cullen. The lines on her face relaxed. Ryber and the first mate were together, and it was more than just a dalliance. It was serious, and it ran deep. True. Safi's lips pursed. She and Ryber seemed to be around the same age, yet here was something Safi knew little about. She'd had romances in Benyatsa City, flirtations with young men like the chiseled cheater, but those encounters had always ended in quick kisses and even quicker goodbyes.
"Does the prince," she asked absently, "have relations with anyone?"
Safi tensed, instantly wishing she could snatch back those words. She didn't know where they'd come from.
"I mean, is it allowed for Prince Merrick's crew to have relations?"
"Not with each other,"
Ryber answered.
"Also, we're off Nubrevnin soil, Domna. That makes the prince Admiral Nihar."
That caught Safi's attention, and she embraced the distraction wholeheartedly.
"The prince's title changes according to where he is?"
"Sure it does. Doesn't yours?"
"No."
Safi bit her lip as a fresh burst of salty wind lashed behind the barrels. Rather than cool her, though, it seemed to scald, to make fresh sweat bead on her brow. But this was a different heat from before. An angry heat. A frightened heat. And she only got hotter, as Ryber went on to describe how Merrick's rationing of meals had upset a lot of men, and only widened the gap between those who supported Merrick and those in favor of Princess Vivia. How dirty and overcrowded the capital city had become since the Great War. The potent truth behind these stories made Safi's ankles bounce and her fingers curl. The world that Ryber described was nothing like the one Safi had left behind. There was poverty in the Dalmati Empire, of course there was. But there wasn't starvation. Perhaps Merrick did need trade, even with a cursed estate like the Hastrals. Just as Safi towed in her leg to stand, to return to the cabin and check on Isolt, Evrain's voice hit her ears. "So you will let the girl die?" Evrain's shout swept up from the nearby ladder, louder than the drilling sailors, louder than the pounding drum. "You must take us ashore." Ice slid down Safi's spine, splintered through every piece of her. She rolled onto her knees, onto her feet. Then she stood, ignoring Ryber's whispers to stay hidden. Just as she lifted above the barrels, Merrick's dark head appeared on the ladder. He climbed deftly onto the deck, his aunt's cloaked figure behind. Merrick strode several paces forward, head swiveling as if he searched for someone, and sailors cleared aside. Evrain stalked to his side. "That girl needs a fire witch healer, Merrick. She will die without one." Merrick didn't answer. Even when Evrain's voice lifted with fury and she demanded that Merrick take them ashore. Safi's fingers flexed. Her toes, her calves, her gut. Everything tensed for action. If Merrick wasn't willing to save Isolt's life, then that simply confirmed he wasn't Safi's ally. So contract or not, enemy sailors or not, Admiral Nihar was now Safi's opponent. And this ship was her battleground. 20. Merrick had gone below decks to check on the Domna. He didn't like how he'd left her in the cabin. Her thread sister was ill, and Merrick understood how that could wrinkle a person's disposition. Whenever there were wrinkles, Merrick had to smooth them out. Besides, this was basically the only wrinkle he could fix at the moment. Vivia's voice switch was hounding Herman, demanding that Merrick tell her where the Dalmati trade ship was, and refusing to back off until she had seen this new Hastral contract for herself. Merrick had lied, again, and claimed the trade ship was only half the distance it actually was. But he had a feeling Vivia was starting to catch on. Before he could reach the passenger cabin, his aunt intercepted him at the bottom of the ladder. "We need to stop," she declared, her face dark in the shadows but her silver hair glowing. "Isolt is too ill to survive much longer. What ports are near?"
"None that we can visit. We're still in Dalmati territory."
Merrick tried to step onward. Evrain cut him off, bristling.
"What do you not understand about too ill to survive? This is non-negotiable, Merrick."
"And this is not your ship to command."
Merrick didn't have the patience for this right now.
"We stop when I say we stop, aunt. Now stand aside so I can visit the Domna."
"She is not in the cabin."
And just like that, the familiar pressure ignited beneath Merrick's skin.
"Where?" he asked softly. "Is she?"
"Topside, I assume."
Evrain flicked her wrists disinterestedly at the cargo space, as if to say,
"You do not see her here, do you?"
"Yet," Merrick continued, his voice still dangerously low,
"she was supposed to stay below decks. Why didn't you keep her in the cabin?
Because that is not my responsibility.
At those words, Merrick's temper fanned into flames. Evrain knew what was in the Hastral contract. She knew that Safiya had to stay below decks for safety reasons. A single drop of her blood could mark the end of the contract entirely. And the thought of Safiya spilling blood. Of her getting hurt. He sprang up the ladder, his aunt's words following him.
So you will let the girl die? You must take us ashore.
Merrick ignored his aunt. He would find Safiya and explain to her, gently, of course, and not with this fire controlling him, that she absolutely could not leave her cabin. She would listen, obey, and then Merrick could relax again. No more wrinkles in sight.
Merrick barked at his men to stand aside as he aimed for the quarter deck.
His magic wanted release, and try as he might, he was helpless to smooth it away.
Admiral!
Merrick ground to a halt. That was Safiya's voice. Behind him. He twisted back slowly, his chest heaving now, his winds throbbing inside worse than before. Worse than they'd been in years. His control was slipping away.
It shattered completely when he saw her standing at the center of the deck, a cutlass in hand.
You will take us ashore.
Her tone was cold and exact.
You will take us now.
You disobeyed orders,
Merrick said, inwardly cursing. What happened to a gentle explanation?
I told you my word is law. I told you to stay below decks.
Her only response was to raise the cutlass high.
If Isolde needs a fire witch healer, then we will go ashore.
Distantly, Merrick realized that the wind drum had stopped pounding, that the ship had started to rock without the tide witches to keep it calm. Merrick swept out his own cutlass.
Go below decks, Domna. Now.
That made Safiya smile.
A vicious thing.
And she stepped calmly up to Merrick's blade. Then she rolled back her shoulders and pushed her chest against the tip. Her shirt dimpled in.
Get a fire witch healer, Admiral, or I will make sure your contract is ruined.
Heat pounded behind Merrick's eyeballs. Safiya would open her own skin. She would spill blood and Merrick would lose everything he'd worked for. Somehow she knew what the contract said, and she was testing him. So Merrick lowered his blade.
Then he gave in to his rage. The winds swept free, blasted over his sailors. Cullen, take her air!
Safiya's face drained of blood.
Coward! She snarled. Selfish coward!
She attacked. Merrick barely had enough time to launch himself backward toward his cabin before her blade slashed the air where his head had been. He flew toward the quarter-deck. The word coward hitting his ears from all directions, it writhed from his sailor's lips, and as he lowered to the deck, he found Cullen's eyes in the crowd. The first mate shook his head, a sign that he would not help this time. Then Merrick understood why. His father's sailors only saw a woman, a Kartoran woman at that, who'd called their new admiral a coward. If Vivia or Seraphin were leading this ship, then justice would be swift, thorough, and violent. These men expected that, demanded it. And it wasn't as if they knew about the Hastral contract. Which meant Merrick was going to have to fight Safiya von Hastral, and he would have to do it without spilling her blood. Merrick's feet touched down, and there was the girl, hurtling toward him with her braid flying behind. Sailors dispersed from her path, their attention on what would come next. Then Safiya was before him, cutlass arching out. Merrick met it with his own. Sparks blazed along the steel, This girl was strong. He needed to get the blades out of this fight as soon as possible. Even the slightest nick could be too much for the contract.
Another hacking blow from the girl.
Merrick parried, but his back was against his cabin. Worse, the world was angling sharply left, and the ship was in that pausing stillness between heaves. The girl used that inertia, and by the wells she was fast. One slash became two, three, four. But there, the ship lurched the other way and her knees wobbled. She had to widen her stance before unfurling her next attack. Merrick was ready. When her blade swung high, he ducked low. Her sword thunked into the wall and Merrick tackled her. Yet the instant she was over his shoulder, her fists hammered into his kidneys, into his spine. His grip loosened and the ship rocked. He felt his balance go. She'd hit the deck head first. So he tapped into his wind witchery. Air gusted beneath the girl, flinging her torso high and returning Merrick's balance, until she wrestled fully upright onto his shoulder and kneed him in the ribs. He doubled over. He couldn't help it. Planks zoomed toward his face. His magic exploded. In a cyclone of power, he and the Domna blasted off the deck. They spun, they tumbled, the world blurred until they were above the masts. Wind whipped around them, under them. Safiya hardly seemed to notice how high they were. Merrick tried to control the power beneath his skin, in his lungs. But there was no denying that the girl awakened this rage inside him. His witchery no longer responded to him, but to her. Her fist launched at Merrick's face. He had just enough time to block it before her foot hooked behind his ankle. She whipped him backward, her body spinning with his until they were upside down, until all he saw was sailcloth and rigging and Safiya's fists thrashing in. Merrick countered, but he pushed too hard. Or maybe his witchery did. Either way, she went twirling out and away from the sails. Then she left Merrick's winds entirely and plummeted, head first, toward 100 gaping sailors. Merrick thrust a magic wind beneath her, propelling her back his way, flipping her and himself right side up. The ocean and the rigging streamed through his vision. Then Safiya kicked him, right in the gut. His breath thundered out, his magic choked off. He and the Domna fell. Merrick had just enough time to angle his body beneath her and think, "This will hurt," when his back hit the deck. No, that wasn't the deck. That was a swirl of wind. Cullen was slowing their speed before... Merrick slammed onto the wood with a brain-rattling crack. The girl toppled onto him, crushing his lungs and ribs. Despite the pain and the shock, Merrick took his chance while he had it. He hooked his knees into hers and flipped her beneath him. Then he planted his hands on either side of her head and glared down. "Are you finished?" Her chest heaved. Her cheeks were sunset red. But her eyes were gleaming and sharp. "Never," she panted. "Not until you go ashore."
"Then I will put you in chains."
Merrick shifted as if to rise, but she clutched his shirt and yanked. His elbows caved. He fell flat against her, noses almost touching.
"You don't fight fair."
Her ribs bowed into his with each gasping breath.
"Fight me again, without magic."
"Did I hurt your pride?" He chuckled roughly and dipped his mouth toward her ear. His nose grazed down her cheek.
"Even without my winds," he whispered,
"you would lose."
Before she could respond, Merrick rolled off her and shoved to his feet.
Take her below and chain her.
Safiya tried to scramble up, but two sailors, men from Merrick's original loyal crew, were already upon her. She wrestled and roared, but when Cullen stepped stonily to her side, she stopped fighting. Although she didn't stop shouting,
I hope you burn in hell, your first mate and your crew. I hope you all burn.
Merrick turned away, pretending not to hear, not to care. But the truth was, he did hear, and he did care. 21.
It took Edwin mere minutes to get Emperor Henrik to hire him, but any time saved was lost while getting his new companion, the foppish Prince Leopold, as well as 8 hellbard escorts out of the palace. 2 hours after leaving the Doge's personal office, Edwin finally found himself jogging beside Leopold's carriage and heading to the Southern Wharf District. Traffic was dense. People had come from all corners of Vinyatsa City to see the Doge's burned-down palace, or to see, as most people referred to it, what the thrice-damned fire-eating Marstocks had done. Edwin had no idea how that rumor had started, but he suspected it had been started. Perhaps a loud-mouthed palace guard had blabbed, or some war-hungry diplomat had intentionally let the rumor slip. Either way, animosities for the Marstocks were high as Edwin jogged the streets and bridges of Vinyatsa City. A bad sign for the 20-year truce renewal, and everything about the situation felt guided, strategized. Someone wanted Marstock as the enemy. Edwin filed that away to tell his father. He also filed away the fact that, of the 8 hellbards in Leopold's employ, only the commander was still breathing normally inside his helm after 2 blocks of jogging. So much for an elite fighting force. Then again, Edwin was shamefully exhausted himself by the time Leopold's carriage clattered into the Southern Wharf District, where the Kartoran warships creaked. It was almost evening, and Edwin's newly healed muscles burned from the exertion. His fresh skin was overheated from the crowded streets, and his old scars wept blood once more, which meant his only clean shirt was now stained through. Oh, Edwin couldn't wait to exact revenge, somehow, when he saw that Thread Witch again. Leopold staggered out of his carriage into the hot sunset. He wore a teal velvet suit that was far too fine for sailing, and at his hip was a cutting rapier with a gold cage hilt, more for flash than use. But money was money, and Edwin's new lockbox of silver thalers inside the carriage was easily worth baking in the sun and listening to this foppish prince's endless stream of complaints.
What?
The prince called out, a gloved hand over his mouth.
Is that stench?
When none of the hellbards stepped forward to answer, when in fact they all stepped just out of earshot, as if intentionally avoiding conversation with their prince, the duty of a response fell to Edwin.
That stench, he said flatly, is fish.
And the feces of filthy Dalmatis,
hollered a bearded man striding down the pier. He wore the emerald green coat of the Kartoran Navy, and judging by his high chin and the 3 men scurrying at his heels, he was the admiral that Leopold was supposed to meet. The 4 officers formed a line before Leopold and popped curt bows along with 4 rounds of, "Your Imperial Highness." Leopold smirked like a boy with a new toy, and as he adjusted his sword, he declared in Kartoran,
"Board your ships, men.
The fleet sets out with the tide, and according to this monk, it is a new Brevnen that we hunt." The admiral shifted his weight, the captains traded glances, and somehow the hellbards slunk even farther away. For of course there would be no sailing with the tide. A single ship sailing to Nebrevna was risky at best. An entire fleet was a suicide mission. Everyone here knew that except the one man who ought to. The imperial heir to Kartora. Yet none of the officers seemed inclined to speak up. Not even the admiral. Inwardly, Edwin groaned. Surely these people did not fear this vapid prince. Edwin could understand fearing Emperor Henrik, but the emperor was not here to loose his waggle-toothed ire. Edwin turned sharply to the prince and said in Dalmati,
"You cannot bring a fleet to Nebrevna."
"Oh?" Leopold blinked.
"Why not?" "Because it would be useless."
Leopold flinched, and his cheeks flared red, the first sign of a temper. So, though it killed Edwin to do it, he tacked on a brusque,
"Your Imperial Highness."
"Useless, is it?"
Leopold thumbed the edge of his lips.
"Am I missing something, then?"
He twisted to the admiral, and in clipped Kartoran he asked,
"Isn't this what navies are for? Reclaiming things that warmongering Nebrevnans take from you?"
Leopold's cheeks twitched as he spoke, and Edwin amended his earlier thought. Leopold might indeed possess a terrifying temper, particularly if one's admiralty depended on his ignorant princely whim. So with a harsh exhale, Edwin spoke up once more. He had no admiralty to lose, after all.
"Navies are for sea battles, Your Imperial Highness, meaning at sea. Yet we do not go to Nebrevna for battles because the Domna will likely be in Lovats by the time your warships can even reach the Nebrevnan coast. Were I this Nebrevnan wind witch, that is where I would take her."
Leopold's cheeks ticked again, and when he spoke, it was in Dalmati and addressed to Edwin. "Why does the girl's arrival in Lovats make a difference? A Nebrevnan kidnapped my uncle's betrothed. We claim her."
"The 20-year truce," Edwin said, "does not allow foreign vessels to touch down on a nation's soil without permission."
"I know what the cursed truce says, but I repeat, they have my uncle's betrothed. That is already a violation of the truce."
"Except that it isn't," Edwin thought. But he didn't feel like arguing, so he only gave a sharp nod.
"The only way to access Lovats is to sail past the sentries of Noden, and those stone monuments are heavily guarded by Nebrevnan soldiers. Assuming your fleet could get by, which they couldn't, they would still have to contend with the bewitched water bridges of Stefan Eckhart."
"So?"
Leopold's voice was lethally devoid of inflection. "What am I supposed to do, then?" The admiral, his captains, and the distant hellbards collectively flinched, and Edwin no longer blamed them. At least Henrik understood war and costs and strategy, not to mention basic history. Yet this was an opportunity for Edwin. A good one, the likes of which he might never have again. It was a chance to gain the trust of a prince. "A single ship," Edwin said slowly, twisting his wrists, inward 3 times, outward 3 times. "We need the fastest frigate in the fleet, as well as every tide or wind witch available. If we can intercept the Nebrevnans before they reach their homeland, we can claim the Domna without affecting the truce. Your Imperial Highness." Leopold eyed Edwin, the Vinyatsin breeze lifting his pale curls in all directions. Then, as if coming to some internal decision, he tapped his rapier hilt and nodded at Edwin.
"Make it happen, monk! Immediately!"
So Edwin did just that, smugly pleased to have 4 officers and 8 hellbards, all of them eyeing Edwin's bloodied chest warily, now forced to take orders from him. The experience was also disconcerting. People rarely stared at Edwin directly, much less stood in such close proximity. So when the planning finally ended, and the men returned to ignoring him once more, Edwin found himself relieved. It was as he returned to Leopold's carriage, after overseeing the transport of his lockbox onto a Carturan cutter, that a familiar scent wafted into his nose. He paused 2 steps from the carriage and sniffed the air. Clear lake water and frozen winters. Edwin knew that smell, yet he couldn't pin down the corresponding blood. Leopold smelled of new leather and smoky hearths. The hellebards stank of the noose and cold iron, and the officers all bore distinctly oceanic blood scents. Whoever had recently passed this pier, Edwin had met them but had not bothered to record their scent, which meant they were not important. So, shrugging aside the smell, Edwin tugged his hood low. The 17th chimes were tolling, which meant Edwin had just enough time to find 14 Redenza Street, and to finally update his father on this latest, most lucrative employer. 22. Manacles rubbed against Safi's wrists as she watched Izzult's sleeping face. There was an unmistakable line of drool lingering on Izzult's lips, but Evrain was gone, and Safi was chained too far away to do anything. She could do nothing that mattered, it seemed. She'd acted like a child by letting her temper explode at Merrick, and she didn't care. What she cared about was that her attack had failed, that she'd only made things worse in the end. The room was dim, clouds rolling over the afternoon sun, and water sloshed behind her. The ship was gaining speed. The rocking all but stopped, and the giant drum booming once more. The stomp of sailors' feet had also resumed. Safi drew her knees to her chest. Her chains rattled, a mocking sound. That was quite a display. Safi lurched upright and found Evrain in the doorway. Light as a mouse, the monk crossed the room to Izzult. "How is she?" Safi asked. "What can I do?"
"You can do nothing chained up."
Evrain dropped to the floor and draped a hand over Izzult's arm.
"She is stable. For now."
Safi's breath burst out. For now wasn't long enough. What if Safi had initiated something she couldn't complete? What if Izzult never woke up? Could never wake up? Evrain twisted towards Safi.
"I should have kept you in the room. I am sorry for that."
"I would have attacked Merrick below decks or above."
Evrain sniffed dryly.
"Are you injured from your sparring?"
Safi ignored the question.
"Tell me what's wrong with Izzult. Why does she need a fire witch healer?"
"Because there is something wrong with Izzult's muscle, and that is a fire witch healer's domain."
Evrain plucked a glass jar from within her cloak.
"I am a water witch healer, so I specialize in the fluids of the body. My salves,"
she flourished the jar at Safi,
"are from earth witch healers, so they can only heal skin and bone."
Evrain set the salve on the palate.
"There is inflammation in Izzult's muscle that is bewitched. Either the cut on her hand or the arrow wound in her arm was cursed. I cannot tell which, but it is undoubtedly the work of a curse witch."
"A curse witch?"
Safi repeated. Then again,
"A curse witch?"
"I've seen spells like this before,"
Evrain continued.
"I can keep the curse clear of her blood, but I fear it will still spread through her muscle. As we speak, it moves for her shoulder. If it gets much closer, then I will have to amputate, but that is risky to do on my own. It is best done with an Earth Witch Healer and a Fire Witch Healer to help. Of course, even if we had such witches available, most Earth Witch Healers are Kartorin. Most Fire Witch Healers are Marstucky. Merrick would never allow such enemies on board.
They are not enemies now, Safi muttered, her mind still reeling from the idea of amputation. That word seemed so strange, so impossible. The war ended 20 years ago.
Tell that to the men who fought in it. Evrain gestured toward the main hold. Tell that to the sailors who lost their families to Marstucky flames.
But healers can't hurt.
Safi pushed her fingers against the wood until her knuckles cracked.
Isn't that part of your magic?
Oh, we can hurt, Evrain answered. Just not with our power.
Safi said nothing. There was nothing to say. Every breath that passed, the deeper into hell she tumbled, and the less likely Isolde was to survive. Yet even though Safi was chained, she wouldn't give up.
Merrick's treaty, her uncle's plan, and even her own future could be damned and thrice damned again. Safi would find a way to get off this ship, and she would get Isolde to a Fire Witch Healer.
So you are a noble woman, Evrain said. Yet you clearly know your way around a blade. I wonder how that happened.
She carefully reached for her healer kit at the foot of the pallet. Then, with precise movements, she untied the bandage on Isolde's arm. The drum pounded and pounded and pounded.
In New Brevna, Evrain continued, we call our domes and domnas visors, and my family's land, the Nehar Holding, was southeast of the capital. A crap holding, to tell you the truth.
Evrain threw Safi a wry smile as she ever so carefully peeled back the bandage.
But crap holdings tend to breed the most power-hungry visors, and my brother was no exception. He eventually won the hand of Queen Janna, and the Nehars were inducted into the Royal Snakes.
The Kartorin nobility is the same, Safi thought.
Vicious, cutthroat, lying. While a man like Merrick might feel duty-bound to his land and his people, Safi had never suffered that loyalty. The Hestral people had never wanted her, nor had her fellow domes and domnas. And as Uncle Aaron had so succinctly put it, Safi wasn't exactly cut out for leadership. Evrain set aside the dirty bandages and reached for her jar of salve.
Politics is a world of lies, and the New Brevnan court is no different. Yet when my brother became king, she frowned and opened the jar. When Seraphin became king and admiral of the Royal Navy, he became the worst snake of them all. He puts visor against visor, son against daughter. Even his own. I stayed a few years after the family moved to Lovats, Evrain went on. But eventually, I gave up. I wanted to help people, and I could not do so in the capital.
Evrain replaced the tub in her kit, and then waved her witch mark in Safi's direction.
It is part of being blessed with water witch healing, I suppose. I need to help, and when I am idle, I am unhappy. So, years before the truce began, I gave up my title and traveled to the Sirmayan Mountains to take my Carowin vows. The wells have always called to me, and I knew that I could help others with a white robe upon my back. Where do you come from, Domna?
Safi sucked in tiredly. Her chains shook with the movement.
I am from the Orin Mountains in central Kartora. It was cold and wet, and I hated it.
And Isolde is from the Midenzi settlement.
Evrain laid the new linen over Isolde's arm, and with almost painful slowness, eased it around her bicep.
I remember it now.
Sophie's lungs compressed. Silver hair, a healer monk. You, Sophie exhaled. You were the monk who found her.
Hi, Evrain answered simply, and that is a very significant thing. Evrain angled a grim look Sophie's way. Do you know why it is significant? Sophie wagged her head slowly.
It's an incredible coincidence?
Not coincidence, Domna, but Lady Fate at work. Do you know Eurydice's lament?
You mean the songs that drunken sailors sing?
Evrain chuckled softly.
That is the one. Though it is actually part of a much longer poem. An epic, really, that the Carowin monks believe to be...
She paused, her gaze unfocusing as if she searched for the right word.
A foretelling,
she finally said with a nod.
For Eurydice was a sight witch, you see, and many of her visions eventually came to pass. Ever since I joined the monastery, I have felt, Domna, that I was part of that lament.
Sophie turned a skeptical eye on Evrain. From what she knew of the song's lyrics, it was all about betrayal, death, and eternal loss. Hardly the sort of thing one would want to be real, much less a prophecy of one's own personal path. Yet when Evrain spoke again, it was not of Lady Fate or foretellings, and her attention had returned to Isolde's delicate face.
Isolde is very sick, she murmured, but I swear by the origin wells that she will not die. I will die before I let that happen.
Those words shook through Sophie, resonating with such intense truth that Sophie could only nod in return, for she would do the same for Isolde. Just as she knew, Isolde would always do for her. Merrick stared at the table of charts before him, at the ether-witched miniature Vivia had procured. Cullen leaned against the wall nearby, stiff and expressionless. The cold in the air was the only sign of his anxiety. Sunlight peeked through the clouds, and the Jana dipped and rose with the ocean's roll. On the map, the miniature Jana cruised smoothly onward, but not the Dalmati trade ship. It had slowed significantly and would soon reach the exact place Merrick had told Vivia it would be, and it would arrive at the exact moment he'd told her as well. Merrick's lies were becoming truth right before his eyes. He supposed he could try to stop his sister with some new tale about the trade ship abruptly changing course, but he doubted she would believe him. In all likelihood, she was already in position, waiting for her unsuspecting prey to sail past. "I have dug us a deep grave," Merrick said, voice rough.
"But you'll dig us back out again."
Cullen spread his hands.
"You always do."
Merrick tugged at his collar.
"I was careless, blinded by my excitement over a thrice-damned contract, and now..."
He exhaled sharply and turned to Cullen.
"Now I need to know if you can do what needs doing."
"If you mean," Cullen said impatiently, "how are my lungs? Then they are perfectly fine."
The temperature dropped further. Snow flickered around Cullen's head.
"I've had no issues in weeks, so I promise,"
Cullen placed a fist over his heart,
"that I can fly to Vivia's ship and keep her from piracy, at least until you arrive."
"Thank you."
"Don't thank me."
Cullen shook his head.
"It is sheer luck that we are here and not in Vinyatsa City. If we were still on the other side of the sea, then we wouldn't be able to intervene at all."
A pause. Then the air warmed slightly.
"There is something else we should discuss before I go."
Merrick didn't like the sound of that.
"The Matsi girl below decks,"
Cullen went on.
Do you have a plan for her?
Merrick inhaled wearily and checked his shirt, still tucked in.
I'm working on it, Cullen. I won't let her die, all right? But the Jonna and our people must come first.
Cullen nodded, seemingly satisfied.
Then I will do what needs doing.
As will I, Merrick said. Now gather the crew and summon the Tide Witches. It's time to haul wind.
23. It was nearing sunset, and Yvraine had departed to find food, leaving Safi to contemplate Isolde and Lady Fate all alone. Surely the odds of Isolde encountering the same monk who'd helped her were high. After all, how many Carowind monks could there possibly be on the continent? And surely this reunion was more akin to chance and probability. Like Rhyber drawing the Paladin of Foxes from the tarot deck, than it was to some ancient poem steering the monk's life. At the sound of approaching footsteps, Safi's thoughts scattered. The cabin door creaked open to reveal Merrick, a wooden bowl in hand. Her lips curled back. "Come to fight me again?" It was a churlish comment, but Safi couldn't bring herself to care.
"Should I?"
He strode into the cabin and towed the door shut.
"You don't seem to be misbehaving."
"I'm not," she grumbled. And it was true. Despite wanting to snarl and shout and make him regret ever putting iron against her skin, she wasn't stupid enough to waste the energy. Now, more than ever, she needed a plan.
"Good."
Merrick marched over and set the bowl within grabbing distance, though he wisely stayed back. Chains jangling, Safi peeked into the bowl. Pale soup with a dry roll floating on top. "What is it?"
"What we always have."
Merrick sank into a crouch. Their eyes met. His were a rich dark brown. Yet he seemed distracted. The triangle on his forehead sunk to a frown.
"It's mostly bone broth. And whatever else we can find for the pot."
"Sounds delicious."
"It isn't," he shrugged. "But look, I'll even break your bread."
He plucked the roll from the bowl, and with an almost apologetic smile, he ripped it apart and dropped each bite-sized chunk into the broth. Safi watched him through half-lowered lashes. "Is this some trick? Why are you being nice to me?"
"No trick."
More bread plucked into the bowl.
"I want you to know that I understand why you attacked me."
Slowly, he pulled his gaze back to Safi's. It was somber now, bleak even.
"I would have done the same thing in your position."
"Then why don't you stop? If you understand, why don't you take Isolde ashore?"
Merrick's only response was to grunt noncommittally and dropped the last of the bread into the bowl. Safi stared at it, bobbing in the broth, and frustration boiled up her shoulders.
"If," she said quietly, "you expect me to be grateful for soup?"
"I do," he interrupted. "We don't have much food on this ship, Domna, and you're eating my dinner ration, so yes, a bit of gratitude would be nice."
Safi had no retort for that. In fact, she had absolutely no words at all. And her wariness suddenly doubled. What did Merrick want from her? Her magic sensed no deception. Merrick nudged the bowl.
"Eat, Domna. Oh, wait. I almost forgot."
He withdrew a spoon from his coat.
"How is that for service? Do you know how many men on board would kill for the use of a spoon?"
"And do you know," she retorted, "how many men I can kill with a spoon?"
That earned her a lazy smile, but when she reached for the spoon, Merrick didn't release it. Their fingers touched, and heat coiled up Safi's arm. She flinched, her hand and the spoon shooting back.
"We'll be stopping soon," Merrick said, seemingly unaware of her reaction. "There might be fighting, and I wanted to warn you."
"Who will be fighting?"
Safi's voice was oddly high-pitched, her fingers still humming as she gripped the spoon.
"Are Isolde and I in danger?"
"No."
Merrick's head shook once, but the word and the movement frizzed against Safi's power. "False."
"I will keep you safe," he added, almost as an afterthought.
Safi's magic purred, "True." Frowning, she sipped the soup. It was disgusting. Even as hungry as she was, bland to the point of tasteless and cold to the point of congealed.
"Don't watch me eat," she huffed. "I won't actually kill anyone with the spoon."
"Think Nodin." His lips twitched up. "I was worried for the entire crew."
A pause, then a curt wag of his head, as if he shook off some dark cloud that plagued him. When Merrick met Safi's gaze, his eyes were sharp, the sharpest she'd ever seen them, and she had the uncomfortable sense that he saw her, not just the surface of her, but all her secrets, too.
"In all honesty," he said at last, "you are a threat, Domna. That's why I have to keep you in chains. You would do anything for your thread sister, and I would do the same for Cullen."
"True."
When Safi stayed silent except for her soup sipping, Merrick went on.
"Cullen and I have known each other since we were boys, since I went to the Nihar estate where his mother works. When did you meet Isolde?"
Safi swallowed her current mouthful, almost choked on the bread, and then croaked.
"Why do you want to know?"
Merrick sighed.
"Good-natured curiosity."
"True."
Safi's mouth pursed to one side. Merrick was being strangely open with her, which he certainly didn't have to be, and Safi supposed there was no tactical advantage if he found out how she and Isolde had become friends.
"We met 6 years ago," she finally answered. "She works, or worked, I suppose, for my tutor in Vinyatsa City. Whenever I visited him for a lesson, Isolde was there. I didn't like her at first."
Merrick nodded.
"I didn't like Cullen either. He was so tense and hulking."
"He still is?"
Merrick laughed, a full, rich sound that sent warmth cinching around Safi's stomach. With his eyes crinkled and his face relaxed, Merrick was handsome. Disarmingly so. And against her better judgment and strongest wish, Safi found herself relaxing.
"I thought Isolde was tense too," she said slowly. "I didn't understand thread witches back then. Or nomadzis. I just thought Isolde was strange and cold."
Merrick scratched his chin, rough with stubble.
"What changed?"
"She saved my life from a cleaved."
Safi looked at Isolde, stiff upon the palate, and much too pale.
"We were only 12 years old, and Isolde saved me without any thought for herself."
There had been an earth witch near Matthew's shop. The woman had started to cleave with Safi only paces away, and when the earth witch had lunged, Safi'd thought it was all over for her. Hell flames or hagfishes she hadn't known, but she'd been certain they were coming for her. Until Isolde was suddenly there, jumping on the woman's back and fighting like it was her life trapped in the balance. Of course, Isolde hadn't been strong enough to stop the Earth Witch, so thank the gods Habim had arrived only moments later. That was the first day Habim had begun training Isolde to defend herself alongside Safi. More important, it was the first day Safi had seen Isolde as a friend.
And now this was how Safi repaid her,
by sending their lives up in smoke. Safi stirred her soup, watching the bread swirl.
How did you and Colin become friends?
A similar story.
Merrick wet his lips, and with a bit too much nonchalance, said,
Colin has bad lungs. I don't know if you've noticed. It's ironic, really. He's an air witch and can control someone else's lungs, yet not his own.
Merrick gave a dry laugh.
Colin had his first truly bad breathing attack when he was 8, and I used my winds to revive him. Rather straightforward.
Merrick nodded to the soup.
How's the dinner?
I've had worse.
He bowed his head.
I'll take that as a compliment. We do what we can here, with what little we have.
He lifted his eyebrows as if he intended a double meaning. It was lost on Sophie.
What's your point?
That I think you do the same. Make do with what you have. I will help Isolde when I can.
I can't wait that long. Isolde can't wait.
Merrick shrugged one shoulder.
You have no choice, though. You're the one in chains.
Sophie flinched as if he'd hit her. She dropped the spoon and thrust away the bowl. Broth sloshed out the sides. Let Merrick mock her helplessness. Let him laugh at her chains. She had lit this pyre, she would put it out. And she didn't need his or anyone else's permission to do that.
It tastes like crap, she said.
It does.
Merrick gave a knowing nod, which only incensed her more.
But at least I get some dinner now.
He swooped up the bowl and then marched from the room as smoothly as he'd come in. Isolde was stuck in the half-dreaming again. Voices lingered outside of her awareness, and dreams hovered just beyond. Someone was here. It wasn't the people in the ship's cabin, of which Isolde could hazily hear. This presence was a different shadow. Someone who wriggled and writhed in the back of her mind.
Wake up,
Isolde told herself.
Stay asleep,
the shadow murmured. It had a voice she knew, Isolde's own voice.
Stay asleep, but open your eyes.
The voice was stronger than Isolde. It coated her mind with a sticky, inescapable syrup. And though Isolde screamed at herself to awaken, all she managed was exactly what the voice wanted. She cracked open her eyes and saw the cabin's oiled bulkhead.
A boat, the shadow murmured. Now tell me, Thread Witch, what is your name?
The shadow still spoke in Isolde's voice, though there was a giddy layer over her words, as if she constantly smiled.
And do you travel with another girl? A truth witch? You must. For there are only so many Thread Witches at sea right now. 3 to be exact, of which only one is the appropriate age.
Who?
Isolde began, though she had to fight to get the single word over her lips. Her voice sounded a million miles away, and she wondered if perhaps she actually spoke in the real world, if that was why her throat seemed to burn with the effort.
Who? Are you?
The shadow's glee solidified, and an icy trickle slid down Isolde's spine.
You are the first person to sense me. No one has ever heard what I say or what I command. They simply follow orders. How is it that you know I'm here?
Isolde didn't answer. Just voicing the one question had sent white-hot pain through her body.
My, my, the shadow declared. You are very ill, and if you die, I won't learn anything.
The shadow pressed in more closely, and its fingers rummaged through Isolde's thoughts.
It's hard to read you anyway. You're quite closed off. Has anyone ever told you that before?
The shadow didn't wait for a reply. Instead, a question thundered through Isolde's mind. Do